Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this part of the weekly teaching where we're looking at the spiritual seasons. First, as we get started, I want to mention that there have been some requests for an outline for these teachings, and so I'm going to try my best to do that. So I will put a link to an outline for this teaching below the video, so check that out. So in this part of the teaching, we've been learning about the spiritual seasons of the year and applying them to the Torah portions and to Joshua. The spiritual seasons are God's yearly curriculum for us. It's the salvation process for us in the year, bringing us a step higher every year with Him. Each step contains all of the elements of our entire salvation journey. That is to say, every year we go through every part of salvation. So every year we go through a rebirth, we go through an adolescence, we go through a time of separation and a time of reconnection and then intimacy with Him and even death. Okay, that's happening on a small scale every year. And the main analogy that we've been using as we've been going through the year is human development. So that same thing I just said, birth, infancy, adolescence, and adulthood. That's kind of our main frame of reference for understanding how we grow at different points in the year and how He helps us to do that. And so that's infancy in the spring and adulthood in the fall. So we actually jumped in the eighth month and with Parsha Noach, just by how things worked out. And so we jumped in the middle at a point that I've been calling the beginning of adulthood and the point of marriage to God, the actual consummation point. The wedding kind of happens in several phases, one of which is Shavuot, but the consummation is actually happening in the fall. And so this is when the wedding is really becoming a reality. So the development point of adulthood and marriage, it's an exciting time. It involves increasing independence. I'm going to go through some ideas that we've kind of been playing with and looking at over the last weeks. So it involves increasing independence, right? The bride stepping up to be the bride. It includes a leaving behind of the old life. We looked at that, especially in Kayasara, that portion. And we have to find a new identity in the marriage. And it involves bringing our own free will offerings to God that go beyond what He has commanded us, right? It's one thing for Him to command us to bring something, and it's another thing for us to come up with our own gifts. The development process in the winter also includes building a home, which we haven't talked about very much yet, and being fruitful, learning to live the life of self-sacrifice, which is the real life. Along the way here, we've connected some elements of the physical seasons, which are echoing the spiritual seasons to us. In the fall, in the winter development phases that we've been talking about. So we connected the coming of the rains to the reconnection of heaven and earth and to cleansing. We connected the growing darkness to the idea of greater free will and also persecution from forces of evil, right, which reside in the darkness. We connected the olive harvest to a kind of light from below, a returning or reflected light. We're getting light in a certain season, and we are reflecting that light back in a season, especially coinciding with the olive harvest and afterwards. And we connected the sowing of the grain crops to the new covenant, the Torah placed in our gut and on our heart. So last week, I know there were a lot of ideas last week. Let's just spend a little bit of time reviewing those. We talked about the growing cold. So that's another part of the physical season that we're experiencing now, which is the growing cold. Our main topic last week was the process of translating the light of truth into action. So this is something that's happening in the cold time of the year. So we said that passion is the key to action. Passion is the key to action. In this season, we need an internal heat, a passion to counter the external cold. And God is allowing that cold for a reason, and it's partly so that we will develop an internal passion and heat. So let me give another example of what I was talking about last week, just to help you see it from another angle. Because it's not at first obvious how the emotions play such a critical role in actually doing. Like, what do we need the emotions for in the process of translating truth to action? So, for example, if I hear a prayer request, I might think in my mind, well, that's important. I really should remember to pray about that. But if my emotions are not engaged for that situation because I lack a deeper understanding of the situation or a deeper vision, a deeper connection, I will have to force myself to remember to pray about that thing or that person. And eventually I'm going to forget. So I'm not going to be consistent. I'm going to falter. I'm going to fall. On the other hand, if I hear that prayer request and I know that person well, or I really take the time to see that stranger, if it's a stranger in that situation, right? Just really pausing, saying, oh, what would it be like to be if I were in that situation? If I take the time to do that, it will touch my emotions, hopefully. And that becomes a different prayer journey, an empowered journey. If I feel deeply the plight of the person, there's much greater energy for action to lift the person up in prayer in this example. And I won't have to try to remember to pray for the person because they will simply come to mind. There's a great power for action locked up in the emotions and lower instincts. And so that is by God's design. The route to action by God's design must pass through these lower aspects of the soul in order to bring this great energy and connection into the situation, if we're going to do it consistently and with power and not fall in that journey. So there's a chain through which our spirit works to accomplish good in this world, to bring heaven down to earth, to translate truth into action, to make a home for God here in the lower realm, the realm of action. That chain begins with the mind. However, the mind is not the center of action, right? We can spend all day thinking about something and never get anything done. The light of truth must move from the mind to the heart and gut and outward through the limbs, the hands and the feet. In last week's discussion, we zoomed in on two keys for moving from the head to the heart. Number one, the new covenant, which is the writing of the Torah on the lower body, the starting of a flame in the lower body. And number two, seeing God, particularly seeing him in the hidden places at this time of year. With the work of Yeshua at Tishrei beginning this work in the lower body, which is the inauguration of the new covenant, and through our own work of seeing, which of course he also guides, seeing him, you know, between the lines, a fire is built up within us, a passion. And this passion is the key to action and the key to fighting the growing cold that is pushing in on us now. That cold is a kind of apathy toward God. And passion and action are antidotes to apathy. That cold can take the form of the godless culture pushing in on us at this season, the temptation to compromise with the culture, right? We need a fire in our bellies, in our hearts, to protect us in this season when, like at Hanukkah, the culture is empowered to push in on us. There's also an application to that just internally and not involving the culture. But it's always a compromise with human reasoning and the culture. So after that review, let's move on to another aspect of the spiritual season, a kind of rest. So that's our big key word for this teaching, rest. I'm not really sure what to connect this rest to in the physical seasons, but I imagine that there's a bit of rest for the ancient Israeli farmer after the grain crops are put into the ground and are growing. That process requires a lot of work, plowing, you know, maybe with the oxen, maybe with the hoe, and planting. And so that's a lot of work. But in the spring, the harvest, that obviously is a lot of work. But there's this middle time where the crops are growing and the rain is coming, where it's maybe a little bit less arduous, at least in terms of the grain crops. So there's a bit of a lull here. I want to connect that to a moment of internal rest we come to with Hanukkah at the end of the ninth month, Kislev. You don't get peace without war. But when the peace comes, we need to recognize that peace. And we need to take a breather, right? God gives us times to have a breather every now and then. So that's what this teaching is about. So last week I mentioned that Kislev is the month of dreams. And dreaming implies rest, right? We have to be at rest to be dreaming. And the darkness is also connected here too. So we talked about the resting farmer a little bit at this time, but the darkness itself is an aspect of resting. So this is the dark side of the year. Last week we connected the idea of dreaming more to the interpretation of dreams, a kind of reading between the lines, a time when God helps us to see him in his hiding places. So a little bit as an aside, a point I want to make here in passing is we don't see God in between the lines if we're not at rest. Dreaming requires resting. Seeing God in these deep places requires actually stopping our movement for a bit, and it also requires a kind of internal rest from worry, a grounded faith that gives our minds the freedom to explore without being too distracted with the cares of life, right? I'm bad at this. I'm moving. I'm in the grocery store. I'm flying with my shopping cart. I've got Jimmy leg that's always going. And so in order to be able to see God in the hidden places, we have to be still. If we want to go deep, we have to find that way to be still, both externally and internally. Now, I know that some phases of life lend themselves to that stillness better than others. Of course, we need to make this stillness a priority, right? We need to make it a priority in every life circumstance. But one thing I want to say here is that if you are single without children, or if you are maybe in a season where the kids are out of the house and your eyes and your mind are still working well and your body isn't yet distracting you too much with its constant aches and pains, take advantage of that season. It won't always be that way. So in any event, I'm sure there's much we could add to the idea that seeing God in his hiding places requires being at rest. But we're going to move on. There's a lot more to get to. So the place of internal rest we find growing as we approach the end of Kislev is obviously reflected in the holiday of Hanukkah, which is a celebration related to the cleansing of the temple after military victories. So part of Hanukkah celebrates entering into a time of rest after battle. I want to suggest that this arrival at a place of rest indicates that we have reached a certain point of maturity in the soul internally. And with the start of the 10th month, Tevet, the work that God is doing moves more to the outside, the body. Deep winter is a challenging time for the body, but the work in the soul for that cycle is largely finished by Hanukkah. Now, I know it's all connected. You can't really separate the body from the spirit in a certain way. But God also shows us a progression of salvation in which the emphasis of salvation is always moving inside and outside and in. Right? It's part of the pattern that we're focusing on different areas. Of course, it's all connected. Obviously, it doesn't mean that we have arrived because our soul has reached a certain level of development for that cycle. The cleansing rains that started near Sukkot continue all through the winter, which means cleansing continues all through the winter. There's still a whole quarter of the year left after Hanukkah, but there is this sense that as Kislev ends, you know, the month we're in now, the focus of growth changes from the dark interior to the brighter exterior, right? It actually starts to get brighter with the beginning of Tevet, so which is the 10th month. Interestingly, we actually have a milestone given to us in Scripture for the first of the 10th month, the first of Tevet, and that is the day that the mountaintops become visible again during the flood. So that is recorded for us in Scripture. Whatever God was doing under the darkness of the water was finished at just this point. And the next phase for the earth was now happening in the light of day, starting with the mountaintops, the most exalted points of the land surface, and working downward from there as the water receded. So point number one for today, we're coming to a place of rest internally when our soulish growth for the year is reaching a milestone and our battles are moving more to the outside, whatever that means. And we'll actually see that in the Torah portion, what that means of an internal rest and more of an external battle. So we at Beth Tikkun are coming to just this place of rest, aren't we? Have we not had an internal struggle and rectification and cleansing going on? And we are stronger for it. And do we not sense that we are at the cusp of a new and more outward focus for our group? This is exactly where we are at Beth Tikkun as we prepare to celebrate Hanukkah, right? We have a little bit of rest here. And then, you know, we're making plans even now to move outward with our work. So point number two is that this place of internal rest is associated with light beginning to shine through the vessel to the outside. This is what the Hanukkah in the window is picturing. The fire that has been growing internally is now becoming visible on the outside as we turn our attentions outward in service, the self-sacrificial life. We want to burn up these bodies and our resources in this service. That which has been a cleansing fire inwardly eventually begins to burn on the outside too, as the body gets consumed in service as a living sacrifice. There's a point in our walks where we start to focus outwardly and people start to see this light, you know, this heart for others, these acts of kindness, this ability to discern the hearts of others and really see them for who they are and help to push them one step in the right direction with a bit of truth dropped here and there into a conversation. This light others can see is associated with increasing maturity. We start to glow, right? Haven't we heard people say that, oh, that person's so amazing, they're so spiritual, they just glow. Now, is it the case that we start to glow with this external fire and the world embraces us like a long-lost relative? Hardly. Some people will embrace us, of course, when they see the light, but The third point I have here is that the shining of our light on the outside brings persecution, attack, right? Yay, more attack. You expose the darkness for what it is. You reveal that there is an alternative to the human-centered life. And it's true, or, you know, it's truer. And it's much better. And the darkness hates that. And this is especially what we see happening at Purim, when Mordecai won't bow down to Haman, and Haman attacks. Right? So, we're reaching this resting point, our light is starting to shine, and attack comes. So here's another important point. Although the attack inevitably comes, the person who has been walking with the Lord to grow stronger internally is going to be equipped to withstand the onslaught and will be equipped to journey with God to thrive through the attack. The darkness turning to attack the light is all part of the pattern. Nothing takes God by surprise. And in fact, God is the author of the pattern. This is what he builds into it, and he does it to make us even stronger. So you see, when the inwardly strong believer walks with God through persecution, clinging to him with the huge muscles of faith he or she has been developing, God uses that believer's faith journey to be an even bigger and bigger light in the world. That little light gets squeezed, and it ends up becoming a massive beacon in the darkness, calling to those who are ready to leave the darkness behind. God's way to evangelize is often by allowing his lights to be squeezed. We know that when you squeeze an atom hard enough, and we just had some news about a breakthrough in nuclear fission, or fusion. When you squeeze an atom hard enough, you get a very big light because God has stored a lot of energy there. He's hidden it there. So one final point here before we turn to the Torah portion. There's no point along this journey that is very easy. So we need to learn how to just embrace the now with faith and even joy. You see, we recognize that every now is both a kind of destination, an arrival, and also a training ground for whatever is next. Enjoy having arrived. And have faith that whatever discomforts are in this moment of arrival, they are preparing you for going higher with God. We need to always know how to be at rest in any given moment, and even joyful. Just look at how far you've come, right? Look at how far you've come, and you'll be joyful. So let's turn now to Parsha Vayeshev and apply these ideas of rest and shining and persecution to this portion. The very name Vayeshev implies a kind of rest. Vayeshev means, and he settled. Speaking of Jacob and his family settling and living in the land of his father's sojournings. This portion begins with Joseph's story. It begins Joseph's story. His dreams of his family bowing down to him, the brothers' jealousy, his sail into Egypt, his framing by Potiphar's wife and imprisonment, and finally, his interpretation of the dreams of Pharaoh's cupbearer and baker. Squished in the middle, there's that another one of these odd chapters, right, about Judah and Tamar, this one, and the birth of her twins. Joseph is the first of the patriarchal line to be at rest. Outside, his life is a mess, though not from his own doing, but internally, Joseph is at rest. Joseph doesn't struggle inwardly. He doesn't struggle inwardly with faith, with knowledge, with emotions. I mean, of course, we see him, you know, he cries a lot, but he knows how to control it. And he doesn't struggle with base instincts either, as we see with Potiphar's wife. None of those. We see him displaying each of these masterfully, and the Bible is not critical of him in any one of these areas. So let me say them again. Joseph shows mastery of faith, of knowledge, of emotions, and base instincts. The one area he is not in control of is his external world, but we know what happens in the end of the story, right? He basically controls the known world. And so at the end of the story, he's controlling that too. Now, obviously, Jacob's family in general has not arrived at a place of this inner maturity. I mean, the brothers have sold their own brother to be a slave. So that's an example how things aren't perfect in the family, to say the least. But Joseph is indicating, just the figure of Joseph, he's showing us that the family that we've been reading about is achieving at least one level of inner maturity in this generation. And in fact, the whole family will be pulled upward to some degree at this level. Joseph is showing us a kind of peace in as much as that generation is capable of it, you know, at that time. So we see that this maturity is associated with becoming a kind of light. Okay, we said that. And it's interesting to me that of all the brothers, it's Joseph that is sent out into the darkness of the world, particularly the darkness of Egypt. Now, he goes first, and he's a light there first, and then the family comes and joins him. So this is God bringing his light to the darkness. But his light obviously brings persecution, right? So there's this kind of maturing, there's the shining of the light, and then comes the persecution. And that persecution is both before and after he is sent out. He gets attacked wherever he goes, in fact. Joseph can't help it any more than light can hide itself in the darkness. It can't. Joseph is just Joseph, and that's a great light, and it brings persecution. His light reveals the dark hearts of his brothers, uncovering the fact that they have insecurities there in their own identity in God. They're jealous that their father favors Joseph. So if I'm one of the brothers, I'm thinking, does this mean that I'm lesser? Does it mean that I'm a failure? The problem is that they don't realize who they are in God. In the end, they doubt their creator and the creation that he made, which is themselves, right? They doubt him. So this is the darkness that Joseph puts a light on. The strange chapter with Judah and Tamar, this also reveals a kind of darkness in one of the brothers, in this case, Judah. The difference here with Judah is that Judah himself just humbly admits to the darkness inside of him. And so he receives a great healing, actually. So the exposure with Judah here ends with healing in Judah. And we see Judah play an important role later. You know, his word is, Tamar is more righteous than I am. And so finally, we see the attack of Potiphar's wife against Joseph when her desire is exposed as evil by Joseph's words. You know, he says, I can't do this to my master. He's left me in charge of everything. And, you know, you're the only thing that's hands off for me. His words expose her, but she's probably thinking, well, he doesn't really mean it. But then his consistent action of rejecting her advances, she realizes, oh, well, there is really someone out there who's like this. And that's exposing her. And so she retaliates by framing him and watching him be hauled off to jail. So the internally rectified person at rest in the Lord is strong, right? Is strong. And Joseph shows himself over and over again to be a spiritual giant. The more he's attacked, the greater his light shines. Let's hope that Joseph was able to look at his time in jail with the proper perspective, that he knew how to embrace the now. Let's hope that he wasn't just miserable there in jail. The Bible doesn't want us to hear that, if it's the case anyway, because it's showing us Joseph as a type of something. And so everything that had happened to him in his troubled life had happened to prepare him for playing a great role in human history. So here we can see quite a good example of how it is that, you know, the squeezing and the problems that he's experienced are real training. So he learned how to manage a household in Egypt, and then he managed a jail, which one would think is probably even more to manage. And those experiences prepared him to run a nation. So again, let's hope that Joseph was able to find the joy in the now of his life. Certainly, at least in looking back, he could say, oh, God was training me all along the way here. Let's turn now to Joshua 4, the second chapter dealing with Israel crossing the Jordan. I'd like to make a connection here once again to the generation in general, the generation that's entering the land. This is a generation that has entered into an internal rest. And it is this state of rest that makes them mighty and unified to fight for the land, which is the external body for the nation, right? We're, part of this is moving from this internal rectification to this external battle. And so here, they're moving into the battle for the land, and the land is the body for the nation. Their internal peace makes possible their ability to deal with that external. It's all based on that internal correction that's been happening for 40 years in the wilderness. It's remarkable in Joshua that there's so little internal dissension among the tribes, if any. These are tribes that are submitted to their leader, Joshua, and they simply are not fighting with each other. They're at rest internally. You could say that they are all in Joshua, completely submitted to him, both mentally and emotionally. You know, we're to be in the Messiah. So here we're seeing a picture of that. The tribes are in Joshua. They're completely mentally and emotionally committed. They're committed and accepting of their lot too, right? They get a certain portion in the land and they just accept it. I can't recall there being any ugly uprisings or rebellions or brother fighting brother in the book. There's a problem with Achan right off the bat when Achan takes some of the banned things at Jericho and Israel suffers as one for it, right? The whole nation suffers as one. Why are they suffering as one? Because of this one individual, because they're of one heart here, unified as a nation. But Achan isn't disagreeing with others. His matter was between himself and God. The problem is dealt with swiftly, and it becomes an important teaching moment from the first battle. This is not, it's not an example of Israel fighting inside Israel. So let me make one point here in Joshua 4 that is not directly connected to our topic today about rest and light and persecution. But it's connected to the theme of the bride, which is a theme we've been talking about a lot. Tim helped me to see last week the visual difference between the crossing of the sea during the Exodus, right, what we call the Red Sea, and the crossing of the Jordan here. When they cross the sea, the walls are standing up on both sides, and Israel walks down the middle. With the crossing of the Jordan, what Tim helped me to picture last week was that the people are more like the walls. The people are the walls. And they stream around the Ark of the Covenant on both sides. Probably they went on both sides around. You got to get a lot of people across that river quickly. And they're told that they need to be a little bit more than a half mile at least away from the Ark. Right? So that's a picture like this with the Ark in the middle. So let me just throw out a possible explanation for the difference between the two. At the first crossing during the Exodus, that's considered a birth moment by the sages. The walls of water are described, even by the sages, as the birth canal. So that makes sense. What's happening as they cross the Jordan is a different picture. Here we see the people surrounding God himself. So God is marking that Ark of the Covenant as especially holy in this moment. So holy that they can't get near it at all. Later, we see them getting much closer to the ark, like when they bring the ark up under David to Jerusalem. They're much closer to it. Here, though, they're told, don't come close to it. So why aren't they allowed to get within half a mile? Because God is there, and he is holy. Right? There's something God is trying to say about the ark in that moment. Still, though, what does it mean that the people surround God as they are crossing? So this is an image of the bride. The one side is the birth. The other side is the bride. The bride surrounds the husband, and fertility is the result. So let me read a verse from Jeremiah 31, the chapter where we read the new covenant. Just above the new covenant is verse 22 in that chapter 31. For the Lord has created a new thing on the earth. A woman encircles a man. In that passage, God is describing the restoration of Israel, the restoration of his bride. The restoration of the bride leads to the bride encircling the husband. And what's new on the earth, in this case, is that it's humanity encircling God, God himself. Maybe that's the picture that we're seeing in Joshua chapters 3 and 4. It's just an idea, something to think about. Certainly it means something. We keep our attention keeps coming to it. But who knows? Maybe that's what it is. So finally, let's bring the discussion to Yeshua. Ultimately, any rest we experience comes from the finished work of Yeshua. Any measure of salvation and sanctification, whatever you want to call it, is really the same thing in my mind. Any measure of that we experience is founded upon him. He is the source of rest. In Matthew 11, he says, come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Yeshua is not only the source of rest, but he himself was always at rest. We have that amazing image of Yeshua actually asleep in the storm-tossed boat, then kind of matter-of-factly getting up and rebuking the wind and the sea. We see his incredible inner peace when he's beaten and put on trial, and he refuses to open his mouth to fight for his life. He had accepted God's purposes for him, and that was that. He was at peace with it. Regarding the persecution of the light, Yeshua had much to say about that persecution, that it was part of the pattern. It was the light of Yeshua that so enraged those directly responsible for his death. They were enraged because his light exposed their darkness for what it was. He didn't have to try to expose them. It simply happens when the light is brought near to the darkness. I think we had really the brightest light just coming at a time of such great darkness, such legalism and such infighting, and such sinat kinam, a lot of hatred among the people, and that was also put onto Yeshua himself. It was a very dark darkness that he was born into, and so we have the greatest light exposed to the greatest darkness. And they're not going to get along, so to say the least. Let me close with a few verses regarding Yeshua's light and darkness, the darkness that surrounded him and what he had to say about it. So in John 1, we read, the true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. In Matthew 5, we read as one of the Beatitudes, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And lastly, in John 15, "If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you." Well, we'll end it there today. Thank you so much for listening. And may you have a blessed Shabbat. And may he make us into the people that he wants us to be. Shalom.